Welcome to The Informed Gardener with your host, Dr. Linda Chalker Scott, Associate Professor and Extension Urban Horticulturalist at Washington State University. And now, the science behind gardening with Dr. Linda.
Hi, welcome again to The Informed Gardener podcast. That long-winded title about being an extension horticulturist, all it means is I take information from good scientific articles all about plants and soils and then translate it so you can use it in your garden. Every week, I'll stretch your mind a little bit by showing you how you can use that great plant and soil science to save time, money, natural resources, and even your back. The information I share is always based on the best current scientific research that either I've done or some of my scientific colleagues have done at other universities. And every week, I try to follow some kind of theme just for fun. And today's theme is plants, drugs, and rock and roll. I'll tell you about devious orchids, how one clever rat uses plants to foil its enemies, and why plants don't respond to the Dirt Band, Casey and the Sunshine Band, or even Handel's Water Music. Think about it for a minute. We'll also head outside to chat with Seattle gardener Robin Haglund and beekeeper Corky Luster about what it takes to be an urban beekeeper. But first, let's look at plants, drugs, and rock and roll in the news. The first article I found today following our theme of plants, drugs, and rock and roll is from Science Daily, and that's sciencedaily.com. It's what I call a science tabloid, and you might wonder, well, why is it a tabloid? And it's because it has great titles like this: Orchid Lures Flies with Scent of Rotting Flesh. This particular orchid from South Africa has a really complicated name. It's Ceterium pumilum. And Ceterium, I normally don't go into the whole thing with scientific names, but this is really interesting how this name came about. Ceterium is the genus of orchids, and they typically have very long floral stalks. And so that scientific name, Ceterium, actually refers to satyrs. And you might remember that satyrs are those mythical creatures that are half horse and half man, or half goat and half man. Anyway, they all had in common very large reproductive organs. So these flowers have very long stalks. Flowers pollinated by flying insects oftentimes have to be on top of tall stalks so that they could be waving around in the breeze when insects come by. But pumilum, the species name of this particular orchid, actually means small flowers. And if you look at this particular species, it has ground-level flowers that are actually nestled between the leaves. So the question is, why does this particular orchid, which is supposed to have this huge long flower stalk, actually have ground-level flowers? They're really not there to attract flybys. Gardeners know that many flowers have food rewards for their insect pollinators. Usually it's nectar, something sugary and sweet. Sometimes it's actually the pollen that they'll eat. But there are plants on the dark side of the forest that deceive their pollinators with empty promises. No nectar or other rewards for services rendered. This particular orchid, the Ceterium, is one of the deceivers. It sends out this stench that smells like roadkill. And as you might expect, it attracts things that like to eat and lay eggs and roadkill and other kinds of dead decomposing meat products. Researchers have found that insects with the unappetizing name of flesh flies routinely visit these types of orchid flowers, crawling around inside looking for the origin of that lovely smell. When they finally crawl out, having not found anything to eat or lay their eggs on, they brush against these sticky pollen sacs that get attached to their backs. So then when the fly visits another orchid of the species, the pollen gets transferred to the flower there. But still, it doesn't really answer the mystery of why the flowers are on the ground. Why aren't they just waving around the top of those long stalks like the rest of their genus? Well, probably it's because flesh flies spend a lot of time on the ground crawling around looking for dead animals, which typically aren't on the end of long stalks, and the flowers need to be able to intercept the insects in their wanderings. The second article I found that has to do with plants, drugs, and rock and roll is from scienceonmsnbc.com. And again, it has one of these great tabloid names: Giant Rat Kills Predators with Poisonous Hair. This title alone was enough to make me grateful I don't live in Africa, where this particular crested rat lives. And as its name suggests, this crested rat has a long ridge of hairs on its back that stands up like a little rodent mohawk. Researchers from Oxford, England, that were curious about this rat, about this crested rat, and it didn't have any predators. Nothing seemed to bother it. And they were very curious after watching one particular dog react to it. This dog cowered, wouldn't come anywhere near it, and actually just ran away from this little velvety varmint, even though the varmint itself was many times smaller than the dog. And it turned out that the dog had had a prior engagement with a crested rat before. So if you don't know how dogs attack their prey, what they pretty much do is they come up from behind, they get their mouth over the back, and they try to break the neck or the back and shake the rodent around. And when this happens with this particular crested rat, these back hairs are holding a deadly surprise and not just a fashion statement. Anything that's unfortunate enough to get its mouth anywhere close to these bristles gets a dose of a poison called wabane, which can cause heart attacks. The poison in the back hairs of the rat actually comes from the bark of an African tree called Acocanthera, and it doesn't come from the rat itself. For some reason, this rat is immune to this poison, and what it actually does is chew up the bark like lethal juicy fruit and use this wabane all over its fur. It just licks its fur, which is really interestingly structured. It has little holes in it and actually wicks up the poison. So it's like these little poison quills that are all up and down its back. That dog had gotten one taste and learned to avoid crested rats forever. That's just another example of better living through plant products. Recently, I visited the urban garden of Robin Haglund, a Seattle horticulturist. This beautiful spot is filled with plants, garden art, and lots of bees. I had a great conversation with Robin and beekeeper Corky Luster about how you can house a bee hotel in your own garden. And if you're worried about the business end of the bees, you shouldn't be. Here's what Robin had to say.
I was a little cautious when we first brought the bees in. I do have a reaction to bee stings, but what I've learned having in my garden for over a year now is that honeybees aren't aggressive. I can get right up next to the hive and they aren't going to come after me. They're very gentle creatures and they're very fascinating. So there's no real problem having them here. They wander around the garden, they don't mess with my dog, and they're just fun.
I guess that would be a good question. If you've got pets, do you really have to worry about the bees too much? And it sounds like the answer is not really.
Not really. My dog now is a puppy, and so we watched her closely when she first encountered the bees, and watched her really closely when she got her first sting, and she did fine with them. You can give dogs Benadryl. You should check with your vet to make sure you get the right dosage for your dog's size, but that's an option. My dog doesn't even need it. She hunts the bees when they're wandering around on the patio, and they coexist just great.
Do you have to run out and find your own hive? Do you steal them out of a hole in a tree? Do you just put a hive out and like the movie says, if you build it, they will come? Or exactly how do you go about getting your urban bees?
Well, if you're lucky, they will move into your space. I know people that have told me that they've had the honeybees move in for them. But really, your best bet is to look for somebody like Corky of Ballard Bee Company, who will come in, help you understand what it means to have bees, make sure that your hive is sited well, make sure your space is appropriate for bees, and make sure that they're the right thing for you.
So since you've mentioned Corky a couple times, let's get his input on how easy it is to have someone come and help you out with having an urban beehive.
One of the things I find is a lot of people don't realize it takes a little bit of time to take care of the bees. There's money that's involved, and also physically it can be kind of demanding. So we set this company up in case some of those criteria are going to be a little difficult for you.
I've got a very small urban garden, and Robin, you do too. So you can barely fit one hive here, or could you fit two or three, or how many hives could you actually fit here? I'll let Corky answer that.
Well, the city regulates that too, up to four hives, and a lot of times it's between two and four hives that I can place in a yard.
One of the benefits, obviously, you're going to get from having honeybees is you're going to have honey. And I know that Corky, with your business, is that's part of what you get in exchange for setting up the hives and maintaining them is honey. How much honey could someone expect out of a hive that's the size of the one that Robin has?
On average, I would say 30 pounds, and it can go up to 120 pounds per hive.
Wow, that sounds great. I mean, enough to keep me in honey. And I imagine, Robin, you've not only wanted them for honey, but for pollination. And what about the flowers you've got? Have you noticed that any of them impart particular taste to the honey, or can you really tell at this point?
I really had thought when we set up these hives, oh, I have so much diversity here. These bees are going to love my garden. They're going to stay here. They take off and fly far distances. And so they're extracting from nectar from all over the city. So it's a very diverse set of flavors that go into the honey. As far as plants go, they love the diversity in the garden.
Why don't you tell us a little bit about what you've got here? I mean, this is just a riot of color. It's a beautiful garden, and Robin does really know her horticulture. Tell us what you've got here that the bees love to visit.
You know, I've got plants that they will visit almost year-round. Dead of winter, they aren't particularly excited about winter bloomers, although they do love Sarcococca, which is a common evergreen plant here. I was shocked to see them going for that, but they did, and that's February. In the spring, they love maples, they love heaths and heathers, they love manzanitas. Later in spring, they're hitting on geraniums. And all sorts of other things. Summer's easy. You know, you've got all your herbs. They love the thyme, the lavender, the sages. Borage is a particular favorite. I've written on my blog about that, how I planted that specifically near tomatoes to lure them in. They aren't big fans of tomatoes, but if they get kind of in that area, they'll accidentally do pollination. And they did last year, very, very much so in my garden. Later in the season, they love anything in the sunflower, the coneflower, any of those types of flowers. They really go for those. Getting even later, they go for hardy fuchsia. There are a lot of plants that are very surprising that the bees will go for. And if you plant diversity, which I'm a big proponent of, you will feed the pollinators. And you won't just have these urban honeybees. You're going to bring in bumblebees. You're going to bring in all sorts of fantastic pollinators that way.
You know, my curiosity, of course, is if you have the honeybees, do they help keep the nastier, stinging, aggressive insects out?
I haven't noticed that they really keep them out. I think more they all coexist together. I've got wasps and yellow jackets and bumblebees and little black, what I think are a native bee. My bee ID isn't anything close to what Corky or other beekeepers could probably do. I know I have a lot of different pollinators. I've got birds that come in and do work for me. The bees pollinate things that the birds later feast on, like autumn joy sedum is a great example. You know, the bees love it when that fires off in the late summer, early fall. Then the chickadees eat all the seeds in the winter. So we create this real happy ecosystem in a very small space in the city.
You mentioned earlier about when we were talking before I started interviewing, that the yellow jackets have kind of a unsavory habit with your honeybees, and I thought that was fascinating, so I wondered if you'd tell us more about that.
Last year, I observed that in the late season that the hive starts getting cleaned out, and Corky can correct me later if I'm wrong, but you know, the drones get dropped out of the hive. They get moved out. They're going to be a drain on the system. And when I saw that really starting to build up, going into the colder season, I also noticed that yellow jackets that hover near the ground would hover near the bottom of the hive where these bees were being dumped out of the hive, and they were looking for them. That looked like a good piece of dinner for them, was my observation. I don't know, Corky, what do you think?
No, we usually later in the summer start dealing with yellow jackets, and they can be particularly difficult on hives that are weak, because once they get in the hive, they can actually start killing bees in there, and they'll start taking pupa and looking for the soft-bodied insects in there. But they also do clean up the weaker bees that are crawling on the ground. And by end of summer, sometimes I can see 30 to 40 yellow jackets hanging around one of my hives.
So they're kind of like the vultures of the insect world, huh?
Yeah, mean vultures.
So they don't keep the yellow jackets down, but you do end up, I guess, inadvertently feeding a lot of yellow jackets. And I mean, yellow jackets have their functions, so I guess that's all right. So I know some people will think, though, that don't bees go dormant when winter comes?
Well, they quiet down. What we say is they cluster up. What they do is, just like the penguins get into a tight ball to warm each other up, they stay inside the hive around the queen in a really tight cluster, and they vibrate their wing muscles to create heat. And it's around 95 degrees in the wintertime inside a hive.
Wow.
Yeah. And while they're doing that, they're also consuming honey, where as beekeepers, we're supposed to leave about 60 pounds of honey for them to consume to make it from about October to around March again.
So they don't just go like the bears do and go to sleep, because they don't have those fat reserves that bears do. They have to keep on eating as they're keeping the queen warm.
Yes, exactly.
Interesting. One of the things we've heard a lot about in the last few years is bee decline or colony collapse disorder, and all these fears that because of pesticides or insect predators or, you know, whatever, environmental conditions, that the bees are going downhill. And I'm kind of curious because in my own garden, I have tons of bees, and I'm not good enough to tell whether they're European honeybees or native honeybees, but I've got all kinds of bees and bumblebees. So from my little tiny perspective, I don't see that, but I know it's true, and I know there's some parts of the country where, you know, the European honeybees are just gone. And I'm curious, Corky, from your perspective, what have you seen with the health of your hives and this whole issue with colony collapse disorder? Do you see that very much?
I do. And even this winter was my worst year yet, and I lost about 40% of my hives. Now, that sounds like a lot of bees to lose, but on average, we're looking at about 30 and 35% losses every year. And that has me really concerned. The Western honeybee is having this issue specifically. And when you start looking at bees in general, there's 4,000 bees more or less in North America. And when you have one bee doing about 70% to 80% of all the pollinating, having losses at 35%, there are some issues that we have to address. And up to this point, we still have not identified what's going on. We're fairly sure it's not a single pathogen. We feel it possibly is a virus working in combination with some other fungus. It could be another bacteria. And it seems like every year they're discovering a new virus that these bees have succumbed to. And we really don't know the answer. And unfortunately, I feel time's kind of running out for the beekeepers, too.
Any thought towards trying to domesticate some of our native honeybees? I know that the European ones have been bred to be calm and, you know, relatively speaking, for a bee. Do our native bees have that ability, or is there research looking at that, using some of the native bee colonies who may or may not be healthier, and see if they can be domesticated?
Well, they are actually working with a number from mason bees, and bumblebees are being used in commercial greenhouses. The problem is a lot of them, I guess, aren't as good at pollinators in general as the Western honeybee. The mason bee is a great bee. I kind of call it the sprinter. It comes out charging. It does a great pollination job, and then it's done by June. In the meantime, we still have cucumbers, and we have to do seed and all these other vegetables and fruits that still need pollination. And I think a lot of farms are starting to think about putting hedgerows in that will support native bees, which maybe can take up the slack. And I think that's really smart. We need to get away from monocrops, which is one of the issues, I think, for a lot of the bees out there, and start thinking about, you know, can this host native bees as well, so they can, you know, help out with the pollination.
So if you've got the fence sitters like myself trying to figure out, do I take the plunge and get into urban beekeeping, what are some quick tips that and caveats that you might have?
Think about how much you want to garden, how intensely you want to plan for providing them food sources, and maybe start there. You know, start there and start attracting the wild bees. Start attracting my honeybees to your garden. They're going to come. Corky's got bees all over the city that'll come, and there are other beekeepers as well. So start bringing them into your garden and see how comfortable you are with that.
One of the wonderful things about having a hive is you're going to be pollinating not only your yard, but also the neighborhood. And it's a great educational tool for children to come see that bees actually can be very gentle and easy to work around. So it's, I feel, a good way to introduce children to bees. My introduction was pouring water on a hornet's nest and getting stung. So I would rather have this positive experience with the honeybee.
That was Seattle gardener Robin Haglund and beekeeper Corky Luster from Ballard Bees discussing what it takes to be an urban beekeeper. We've included some pictures from Robin's garden on the Garden Professors website. That's gardenprofessors.com. Every week on this podcast, I look forward to answering some of your gardening questions based on the theme of our show. Since we've already covered drugs, it's time to consider plants and rock and roll. When I first started teaching, I worked at Reed College in Portland, Oregon, teaching freshman biology labs. At some point during the year, the students would do an independent project, and always somebody would ask, how can I test the effect of music on plants? It struck me as rather strange that people thought that things without ears could actually listen to and react to music, but I thought, well, hey, that's what experimentation's all about. Why not? We'll give it a shot. So it's really no surprise that I finally discovered a book written on the topic called The Sound of Music in Plants. Now, this particular book gets cited all the time on the internet as evidence that plants respond to music, and specifically that they respond negatively to rock and roll music, or what's called acid rock in this book. The book was published 30 years ago or so by a woman who was getting a degree in music, and she needed to do an independent project with a biology professor, and she decided to look at the effects of music on plants. Unfortunately, she went into this with what we call a biased opinion, because she thought that she would find that acid rock would have a negative effect and that classical music would have a beneficial effect. So she goes in automatically with a bias against one of the outcomes. And as a scientist, you just can't do this. You have to be completely objective, which is hard to do. We're all human. Anyway, what happened in this particular study is she had some of the plants exposed to acid rock, some of the plants are exposed to classical music, and then she looked at what they did, and she reported that the ones that listened to the rock music died, and the ones that were listening to classical music flourished. But when you actually read this book to find out how she conducted the experiment, it was really not very carefully controlled. She didn't really measure how moist the soil was. What she did was stick her finger into the styrofoam cup and kind of decide by how wet it felt on whether or not it needed water. This again is not a great way to conduct an experiment, because you can overwater, you can underwater, and sometimes when you're looking for a particular outcome, you'll do that deliberately even though you don't know it. So her experiment came out with the conclusion that acid rock was bad for plants and classical music was good. This was not published in a peer-reviewed publication, not in a scientific journal. It was actually published by an outfit that specializes in New Age literature, which isn't exactly science either. So it's an interesting book. It's worth reading just to see kind of what not to do when you're doing a scientific experiment. And you'll also see how something like this, which is the only published work that I've ever found on music and plants, sort of have ballooned into this huge body of evidence that music affects plants. So anyway, my recommendation to you is not worry about what your plants like to listen to, but listen to what you want to when you're tending your garden. It will have a positive effect on you. This podcast is only one of the ways I provide science-based information for use in your own garden. For more, be sure to visit my webpage, theinformedgardener.com. That's my official WSU webpage, and it's full of free and great information. Second, I hope you'll join me and three of my colleagues at the Garden Professors blog, and you can find us at gardenprofessors.com. The four of us take turns every day posting on just about any gardening topic you can think of, and even some that you probably haven't thought of. You can add comments, you can add questions, we always respond to those, and it's really a fun give and take among all of us. And finally, I've also published some books that might be of interest to you. One of them is The Informed Gardener, I mentioned it earlier. There's a sequel to that called The Informed Gardener Blooms Again. And finally, there's a great big book called Sustainable Landscapes and Gardens. And for more information on those books, you can find them on sustainablelandscapesandgardens.com. In any case, I've hoped you found this podcast and the others entertaining and useful. I welcome your comments and questions. You can reach me at lindacs@wsu.edu. Be sure to join us next week. The theme of the show is going to be Going Native.
You've been listening to The Informed Gardener. For more information on Linda's books, future podcasts, as well as other stories and articles she's written, please visit informedgardener.com, gardenprofessors.com, or sustainablelandscapesandgardens.com. Thank you to Large Media, executive producer and production direction, and the WSU faculty and staff. Happy gardening!